So welcome to the Sphere Research Podcast, Sport, Physical Activity and Health Equality. I'm Emma Rich, and today I'm going to be talking with Professor Holly Thorpe from the School of Health at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. Kia ora, welcome Holly. Holly is an award-winning sociologist, and her work in the area of sport, physical culture and gender has earned her international recognition and numerous prestigious awards, including the Royal Society Early Career Research Excellence for Social Sciences. I'm really excited to talk to you today, Holly, about your work. Myself and colleagues were delighted that you could come and visit us in Bath, and you've already been incredibly generous with your time and insights, so thank you for that. I'd like to begin by taking you back to where it all began, I suppose, what led you to becoming interested in sociology?
Kia ora, Emma. Thank you for having me, and congratulations on the launch of your centre. I think that's really exciting, and great things to come, more great things to come.
Thank you.
The work of you yourself and your colleagues is already internationally recognised as having such huge impact, and all the way down in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the work from yourself and your colleagues is used and engaged and is really having an international impact. So congratulations, and
that's
I'm excited to see what's going to come of this new centre. So my story into sociology, I was a competitive snowboarder in a previous life and a snowboard instructor. And I was also studying my undergraduate degree in physical education, and I was, on the slopes, on the chairlift, looking down around me, and started asking some questions around gender relations in this sport, which 20 years ago was quite a new sport, and it felt very different to me versus other sports I'd done in my life, from more organised competitive sports, which, historically and still when I was growing up, separate the boys and the girls, the men and the women. In the sport of snowboarding, I could ride alongside my male peers, and the gender dynamics were different. And it was my supervisor, Professor Douglas Booth, who encouraged me to dig deeper into that. And I started reading more, Belinda Wheaton's work, Becky Beale's work in terms of the gender relations and these informal action sports. And so it all kind of grew from there, and I went on and did my PhD into women's roles in snowboarding culture around the world. And it was really interesting to think about the different histories of sport. Snowboarding had developed in a very different context to football or cricket or rugby. So it had developed in the 70s and 80s, and the gender dynamics at that point in time in society were different. So women were right there in the very beginnings of the sport of snowboarding. And so the different types of politics that we saw, the ways women carved out space in the industry for themselves. They fought really hard for, when they said boys only in a big air competition, the woman would hike up and ride it anyway. And so, I came to it with quite romantic ideas that snowboarding culture was, it's the future of gender relations in sport. As I dug deeper and started looking more closely and hearing from people across the industry, from athletes and journalists and, women participating in lots of different ways, I saw that it was much more complex than that. And that is what sociology is all about, getting into those complexities and recognising that it's not just one individual experience, that there's a culture there. And it was very much a gendered culture. And so that's where my, I guess it was on the chairlifts that my sociological imagination was initially sparked, reading the work of scholars before me really excited me and prompted me to ask new questions that I hadn't asked before. And that's where the PhD sort of came from. And then that after that led into expanding out from snowboarding into gender relations and women's roles and girls' opportunities in action sports and informal sports more widely. So skateboarding and climbing and surfing and mountain biking. And the lovely thing after a PhD is that you get to start collaborating with people. And so I worked with Rebecca Olive from Australia, and we co-edited a book on women in action sport cultures. And then I ended up working with Professor Belinda Wheaton on action sports and the Olympic Games, and that was with started with a grant from the IOC because they were trying to understand what was going on in these alternative informal sports. They recognised that young people were attracted to these sports, and they were very concerned about the ageing demographics of the Olympic Games. And so the project started there, and it continued, and we had that book published based on about 10 years of research, actually. Action Sports in the Olympic Games, Past, Present, Futures with Rutledge. And that through that research, we were involved in the process of surfing, skateboarding and sport climbing being included in the Olympic Games in Tokyo. And this is an ongoing dialogue, of course, as different international federations are trying to understand the quickly changing place of sport in our society and what people are engaging with. So, you know, there's been a lot of politics and the inclusion of these new sports. And so these are some of the areas of my research. But always throughout this, I've been really interested in the issue of gender and women's opportunities and sport more widely.
I mean, it's interesting hearing people's inroads into their careers and what sparks, as you say, that sociological imagination, and that commitment to social justice issues was clearly there from very early on, and your exposure to that culture. Maybe we could pick up a bit here on action sport. I think it's really interesting. What do you think have been the benefits, and how has that changed how we think about gender and sport? What's been the sort of productive aspect of action sports in that regard?
Yeah, I still think it's a really interesting space to think about gender relations in sport. If you go to a skate park, if you go to, you know, to the mountains, you go to a beach and watch people surfing, you're out there surfing, we're not dividing men and women, girls and boys. We're sharing those spaces, and you know, that can go various ways. People don't always want to share those spaces, or particularly when the resources are limited. But I think they do offer us insight into different gendered relations in sporting cultures. You know, as these activities have become sportized, they've gone to the Olympics, you know, people do pursue the athletic path of these sports, and then obviously they are organised into the male competition and the women's competition. But actually, as the majority of people, you know, that's just really the competitive aspect of these sports is just the tip of the iceberg. And the majority, 99% of the participants, are very much engaging at a recreational level. And when we do so, we are sharing these spaces. And so different gendered and social interactions take place. You know, historically, we haven't had coaches in these sports. Often it's been very much peer-to-peer mentoring. And so different types of relationships emerge. And, you know, sometimes different understanding and respect for difference when these activities are well facilitated can emerge. So I think in action sports and in these informal sports, historically, you know, if I'm thinking about skateboarding, for example, there's some really amazing work by people like Indigo Willing in Australia, who've shown us that these informal sports do offer us some alternatives, ways of thinking differently about how we organise sport to be more inclusive of difference and the multiplicities of gender. So we're not male, female, actually. There are ways that we can celebrate lots of different gendered ways of participating. So I think we can learn a lot, actually, from looking closely at action sport cultures. And I'm not romanticising them as this is the future, but I think we can learn a lot by paying attention to when people have sought out alternative sporting and movement cultures, often because traditional, organised, competitive sports structures haven't worked for them. Often these sports activities, they celebrate self-expression and creativity and community, and often people find a lot there. And often, you know, the relationships with the environment are a big part of that as well. And that's obviously, you know, often the environment is a co-participant, whether you're reading the ocean or you're reading the mountain, there is a close relationship with the natural environment in a lot of these sports as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not performed within marked out lines within a time that's, you know, ticking. Actually, there's more fluid boundaries around these activities. And I think we can learn a lot by paying attention.
Yeah, that's really interesting, that relationship with space and place, and also the questions around the function and the role and the meaning of sport and how that's organised. And sort of brings to mind for me some of the debates right now around e-sport, you know, and whether those forms of gaming and digital forms of competition, whether that recreates a different model in the era of the digital. So that sort of brings me nicely into the contemporary moment, I suppose, and the challenges and opportunities that come with the digital. And of course, you've edited a really interesting book series around new femininities and thinking about that in the culture of physical sporting and digital cultures. So what if you could say a little bit more about that for us? Tell us about the book series and what we can find in there.
Yeah, so this is a book series with Palgrave and Associate Professor Kim Toffoletti from Deakin University. The other co-editors on this are Jessica Francombe-Webb from Bath University and Artie Ratner. Yeah, we've had this series running for 5-6 years now, and we've got some great books in that series. And like you say, the digital is certainly a part of that, and something that brings us together. And some of the work that Kim Toffoletti's been doing, and I've been working with her around digital fitness communities and also sportswomen and how they're using social media. Women in sport, the media treated them in particular ways, historically, marginalising, sexualising, trivialising women in sport. And so fed up by the mainstream media, a lot of sportswomen have turned to social media to tell their own stories and to represent themselves and their careers and to build communities and audiences and a fan base. And to, you know, when they're doing that well, they can get some extra funding, which, you know, women often in sport don't have the same funding streams that male athletes do. So there's all these kinds of benefits of them doing this, but obviously it's a whole nother level of expected labour required of them, sort of digital labour, emotional labour. We know that a lot of sportswomen are experiencing a lot of online abuse, and often sports organisations aren't there to support them on the other side of that, or don't understand or historically haven't understood the sort of gender-based violence that women experience in these social media spaces. And so some of my work with Kim Toffoletti has been exploring that, but also looking at fitness communities and the role of digital spaces has been, a wonderful collaboration over the years. And Kim Toffoletti's led that work. But it's really interesting to see the different ways that people and groups and communities are using these online spaces to support their physical activity and movement practices. And there's a huge amount of creativity and community building in these digital spaces. And so it's not all doom and gloom. There's actually some really interesting stuff happening in these digital environments.
They're incredibly complex environments, aren't they? Both sort of offering opportunity, but also, I suppose, new challenges, new
absolutely.
Risks,
and how do we research that? Yeah. And how do we research it, right? It also requires different types of methods and different thinking about ethics in that research.
Absolutely, yeah. Just on that, obviously lots of conversations right now about feminism and what that might mean, and talk about post-feminism and the era of empowerment. And obviously the digital has played a really crucial role in that, hasn't it, in terms of the imaginary of young women. What are your thoughts on that in terms of, you've talked a bit about the opportunities that the digital presents. Are we in an era where there are new pressures for young women and girls in terms of the body? How do we use the digital to mobilise that? What are your thoughts on that in terms of that thinking about the body and affect and, you know, the pressures around, for example, fitspiration? What have you learned through your research around that?
Yeah, it's a quickly changing space too, and that's where the challenges of research to be nimble and responsive. You know, we need to be responding quickly to this digital world that people are occupying, and is not, you know, it's part of our everyday lives. And I have a young daughter, so I'm going to find out, right, as a parent, how we navigate our youth and our children through these digital landscapes in ways that keep them safe, but also that they have agency and that they are able to be critical in what they're consuming.
I mean, I wonder, you know, that notion of being nimble, us as researchers, maybe, you know, how we work with different disciplines, how we think about creative methods, how we do research differently. How important has that been for you in terms of addressing some of these contemporary gender relations, particularly the interdisciplinary work?
Hmm. Yeah, I think something that I've always not struggled with but wrestled with is how to have impact with our work. And, you know, we will spend a huge amount of time doing the research and writing it up and publishing it in a journal or a book chapter or a book. And often the everyday public doesn't have access to those resources. Journals are expensive to get access to those. And then they do have an opportunity to read them, and it's often filled with such academic or theoretical jargon that it's not that accessible to actually engage with the ideas, even when there is an interest there. And so, you know, right from even during my PhD, when I used to be using, say, Foucault or, you know, social theory to make sense of what was going on in snowboarding culture, all the time I was writing for lifestyle magazines, trying to communicate the research for the communities that I was actually doing the research on, and what did they engage with. And there was a kind of an interesting dialogue loop there when you get the feedback in terms of what sticks and, that's an interesting view, or I don't actually agree with that. And so it keeps that dialogue going, and I think that's really helpful as a researcher to know. And, to, you know, obviously I think it's part of our responsibility is to try to share our research with wider audiences. For me in New Zealand, universities are government funded, so taxpayers' money goes to universities. So I feel a responsibility to try to make our research findings accessible in different ways. So whether that's, you know, writing a blog or doing a podcast or writing for different media outlets like The Conversation, working with sports organisations, and that means finding ways to translate our research. So it's not just all that theoretical jargon in the journal articles, but actually what are the key issues to communicate, and how do we find a shared language, or how do we try to translate that to the communities that we're trying to have an impact with? And I find I'm always learning in that space, and working towards it being a dialogue, because I think that's where the really meaningful work comes from, where you actually see your ideas and your research actually having an impact and bringing about some sort of change. That's, you know, I think the most rewarding part of our work.
Yeah, it's interesting, our role as critical scholars and our, I suppose, our own grounding in sociology and leaning towards critique, and I sort of think about Michael Burovoy's core for public sociology. And I think one of the things you do incredibly well is translate your work and make it accessible, and so active in terms of writing for different outlets and different media. I guess for people listening, what would be your kind of tips or advice about starting that process, or, you know, writing for different media?
I think that public intellectualism work, I feel, is really important. As a critical scholar, I think it's, a critical scholar of sport, I think it's good to understand the context. A lot of people out there don't want to think critically about sport. It's something that they love. They just want to love it. Please don't show us any of the problems. We don't want to hear about it. But, for me, speaking and doing research, critical research on sport, is because I love it too, and because I want it to be better and accessible to more people so they can enjoy it as well. And when there are problems or harm is done through sport, I think we can work together to improve that, obviously. But yeah, I do, because I'm trying to translate research and be involved in those dialogues. I do a lot of media work, and I think it's there are risks and rewards with that type of work, that public intellectualism, that public sociology. Advice I'd have is to know your source. When the radio calls up and they say, "Can you talk on this topic at 12 o'clock?" Make sure you know what the style of that media outlet is, or who their audience is. What are you getting yourself in for? Is this going to be a talk back show and you're going to be having to deal with all the callers back? Or, live media versus things like The Conversation, where you have control over what ends up being published. You have the final say. You approve what goes out there. And as academics, we spend years on our research. We sometimes spend days, even a week, trying to get that paragraph perfect. And then, so when we do that media work, which is very immediate, very fast, it's a completely different pace than we're used to. Often different kinds of ethics are involved. There's nothing worse than, I think I learned it the hard way earlier on in my career, feeling a bit flattered when the media called, and then seeing yourself, a quote that's completely decontextualized or used in a way that you don't feel reflects the complexities of your work. And I think that's quite hard. So knowing the source, for me, it's trusting the source. So there are journalists in New Zealand, for example, that I know are not going to throw me to the wolves. They're going to take care. They're going to check it back in with me if they need to. And so I'll say yes when they call. But there's others that I'm much more cautious of. I've been burned a few times. So taking your time and thinking about the source and thinking about what you want to say. And if it's not you in that moment, making sure that you can pass it on to one of your colleagues who is an expert in that space. I think it's important to recognise that that public intellectualism, that public sociology takes a toll. It's exhausting. I think in today's media landscape, there are certainly risks, particularly, I think, for women in that space and people occupying different positionalities other than white men. There are real risks. And whether that's the online abuse stuff or, people finding your phone number and trying to, find where you live because they want to, correct you or persuade you or worse. So there are very real risks of doing that public sociology work. And I think sometimes our institutions aren't there to support us on the other side of that. So to make sure you've got communities of support around you if you want to do that work are things to consider.
It's such sound advice, Holly. Thank you for sharing your experience and insight around that. And just thinking about some of the pressing global issues right now and how heated some of those debates are, and people with different interests And new voices coming into that space as well, and some of the vulnerabilities attached to that. But also some really good, I think, practical advice about what we can do as academics to make the work we do more accessible. One of the things I heard recently was, you know, if you're going to speak to the media, do you have somebody who has had experience of the things that you're talking about? Because, you know, that's really, people can connect with that, can't they? You know, in terms of stories and experiences. And I suppose that takes me into a different area of thinking about how do we represent people, whose voices, and how do you deal with the tensions of that in your work? And I'm thinking back to a paper that you wrote back in, I think, 2018 around the Global South and the representation of girls within some of the marketing and material around funding agencies. They have very good intentions in terms of empowerment. But I think you've really tackled some of those sensitive issues really well in your work. So could you say a little bit more about that for me today? Just how do we think about representation and whose voices? What's our responsibility as academics within that?
Oh,
it's a good question.
All right, question.
Yeah.
My goodness. And I would say, a long journey of learning the different types of ethics of working with, from, and for different communities. And when those are not communities that you are from yourself, I think it's really important to be collaborating and making sure you've got partners from those communities. And, you know, you mentioned that paper that came from us. Quite a long piece of research I was doing on and with a skateboarding organisation that was in Afghanistan. And they were, you know, in their social media work, very captivating images of Afghan girls on skateboards, and really captured the imagination of Western audiences, because there was a really kind of an interesting juxtaposition of Afghan girls on skateboards. And so... but actually, when I was doing interviews with people in that organisation in Afghanistan, they talked about how careful they needed to be with those images. Because although Western audiences might love to see these very, you know, and quote marks, empowering images of girls, those images actually could create quite significant risks for those girls and their families if the wrong people saw them. And it was not until I heard those voices of how the organisation was working very, very carefully and having to really think about the ethics and the logistics of what images they would take and not take, and making sure that the right approvals were in place. And that was something I hadn't heard before. Only when I was doing those interviews that it struck me of, wow, the images that I myself had seen and been captivated by and thought, what's going on here? This is so intriguing. Had to really unpack that and recognise in different cultural contexts, these images can do harm. They can actually put people at risk. And so the organisation itself was working really carefully around that space. And but your bigger questions around communities. So I've done work with Dr. Nita Ahmed in Aotearoa, New Zealand, working with the Muslim community and girls and women's participation. More recently with Shireen Locke around changing participation of Asian communities in Aotearoa and sport, active recreation and play. And so these are both reports for Sport New Zealand. And when you do this type of work, and this is very much, you know, that collaboration is super important with people from those communities, often... you know, sometimes research has done harm in these communities. And so thinking about you know, the risks and the responsibilities of this type of research. And I think sometimes when you do research with communities who have been overlooked in policy or haven't been, you know, haven't felt heard before, sometimes people can get their hopes up. Finally, this organization's going to listen to us. And I think it's when you do that research, kind of consulting work, you can't actually make those promises because you don't know what the organization on the other side is going to do with that report. They might just park it in the drawer and tick that box and it's done. It's over. And so as researchers doing work with communities, it's important not to offer false promises. If you're involved in this research, it might turn out like this, or you might get more funding, or your voices might finally be heard. And actually, to be honest, that we're going to try our best with this research, but we can't promise what sports organisations are going to do with this. So, but I think the most important thing is if you're doing research with communities that are not your own, making sure you're collaborating and making sure you're listening and ready to learn.
Yeah. And I think something that so many people admire about your work is just that commitment to your practices of care and ethics. And it's challenging, isn't it? Because there's so many uncertainties in research, as you've alluded to, and even the notion of a photograph, you know, an image. What does it do? Where does it go? And even in the era of the digital, it's very difficult to know in advance, you know, the power or the potential of that image. But, you know, that idea of collaboration, but also I think co-production and co-creation is really important, isn't it, in terms of this type of work around gender, sport and different physical cultures that we are working with, not on or about these different groups. And again, I think, you know, really impressive work that you've done in terms of bringing those creative practices into your research.
Yeah, I think, thank you. I think one of the, I'm constantly learning. And so over the last few years, I've been doing some work on transgender participation in sport and media representation of Laurel Hubbard, who is a transgender weightlifter from New Zealand who qualified for Tokyo. And we were doing a big international media analysis to see how the media was framing that, often as this debate, you're either on one side of this debate. So quite a way of polarising this issue rather than recognising the nuance and complexities of it. But I quickly learned the importance of collaborating with my transgender colleagues because my assumptions of the good feminist work was not necessarily their understandings of what is helpful here, because the blowback or the pushback is felt differently based on different positionalities. And I guess it comes to those questions of what does it mean to be an ally or an advocate, or what is your role here? And I think making sure, again, that point of making sure if we're doing research on communities that are not our own, it needs to be through collaboration. And it's humbling to realise that your feminism is actually not helpful here. We're bringing assumptions, and I think that practice of reflexivity at all times, sort of our different positionalities, our different forms of privilege, our different assumptions around what is empowerment or what is inclusion might be felt very differently by others. And so that's where I think that power of collaboration is really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, they're really pressing points, aren't they? Not just for gender and sport, but even that idea of who does feminism speak for or about, and who has power to speak.
Exactly.
And, you know, so quickly we fall back into polarized views of these things. And there's a tension, isn't there, to finding a way to be heard, but not doing away with the nuance of some of the complexities that we're looking at as researchers. So, I guess I'll just leave with the final sort of question of anything else you'd like to share with us today about working with sports organisations, particularly in the sort of global context of some of the gender inequalities that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, I think it comes back to, for me, that what is the meaningful work? What is impact? And so I do work with sports organisations. I try to work with sports organisations. I have worked with sports organisations like Sport New Zealand or High Performance Sport New Zealand, like I mentioned before, some work with the IOC. Some of our colleagues might think you're dancing with the devil there. but actually for me, I would rather be at that table and try to offer some different viewpoints or bring the research into the conversation. And I think that's all about relationships, and relationships take time, and relationships require trust on both sides, and that's not going to happen instantly. And often we're speaking a completely different language, and so again, listening, trying to find ways to make our research or ideas translatable. But that doesn't happen overnight. It does take time, and there are some compromises that we are not willing to make sometimes. So sometimes you have to walk away from that table. But sometimes it's better to be at that table and fight for things. And most importantly is to try to open that door up and make sure you're trying to create a supportive space for other voices, voices that might have been much more marginalised than my own. And so not just holding that seat at that table, but trying to hold that door open and trying to create space for others at that table, and trying to create supportive spaces for others at the table, other voices, different positionalities, different perspectives. And this is the hard work, I think, of having our research have impact. But I think it's the meaningful work. And sometimes you don't get it right. Sometimes you make mistakes. Yeah. But I think it's important to keep coming back to that table and keep trying to carve out safe spaces yeah. for others.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good note to end on, really. And your drive for advocacy and change is infectious, and I think you've just done such impactful work. So just to finish, you can find out more about Holly's work, the website, the University of Waikato. And if you'd like to find out more about the research that we're doing around gender inequality, please do visit the Sphere website. Holly, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you today, and I think we could carry on these conversations for hours, but I'm really grateful for your time, and thank you for sharing your insight and experiences through the research pathway around gender and sport. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma, and just again, congratulations on the launch of Sphere. How exciting, and I know wonderful things are going to come from this, so congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.